You are listening to Road to GEM, hosted by Harvard Center for International Development. I'm Priyanka Varma, a Master in Public Policy student at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and we're continuing the series with a goal in mind. We're imagining international development through a gender lens. For today's episode, we are focusing on women's economic empowerment around the world and bringing together global policymakers, donors, and thinkers who are working in this space. I'm really excited to welcome Diva Dhar from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Verena Winder from the U.S. State Department's Office of Global Women's Issues, and Wendy Telecki from the World Bank Group's Women Entrepreneurs Finance Initiative Secretariat for today's episode. To kick things off, I'd like to welcome Diva Dhar. Diva is Deputy Director of Women's Economic Empowerment at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where she leads the foundation's global strategy and portfolio on strengthening data architecture and deepening research and evidence for women's economic empowerment programming and policymaking. Thanks so much for joining us, Diva.
Thanks for having me here.
So to kick things off, can you tell us about the Gates Foundation's Women's Economic Empowerment portfolio, how the team gets started, and what's your approach to tackling issues in the sector?
Our goal at the Gates Foundation is to increase women's economic opportunities by really supporting efforts that help them both generate and control their own incomes. Our work really focuses on not only women's economic opportunities, but also the decision-making power. We know there's an extensive body of research which shows that when women earn and control their earnings, their children, their families, their households are all going to benefit along with the global economy. Our strategy in particular really focuses on improving incomes for over 80 million women, low-income women in South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. And we do this in three different ways. One is attract, advance, and retain. So improving women's entry into the workforce, especially in areas where labor force participation for women is already low. Increase women's average income once they're in the workforce by helping them advance into higher return occupations or improve their productivity in paid work. The third is really helping retain women within the workforce, so avoiding dropouts, which happen, for example, especially after times like marriage or childbirth. So how do we do this? We really want to support solutions in five key areas where we look for breakthrough opportunities. One is on digital tools. So focusing on women's access and use of digital services and tools for income generating opportunities. We're really exploring how smartphones and other digital programs can help women not only obtain better services, but improve their livelihoods as well. We're also looking a lot at markets. So we know that women are highly concentrated in the informal economy, in poor economies with little to no social protections. We really want to connect women to more lucrative sources of income and help them compete in new higher profit markets. We also know that childcare is a massive constraint. So we're testing innovative approaches to reducing childcare burden on women through different kinds of models, but also identifying work opportunities for women in the care economy itself. The other area of work we know is capital. Access to capital is crucial for women, especially those who are entrepreneurs, to sustain and grow enterprises, whether they're micro or medium in size. We're working to improve women's access to capital and financial services, including cash and asset transfers, credit, savings, and assets which we know are crucial for livelihoods. And the last piece of work is around data. We know that there's not usually enough information about women's lives and experiences, and more sex disaggregated, gender-specific information makes women's needs and gaps more visible, especially for decision-making and service delivery, both in the public as well as the private sector. So these are the five areas that we're really focusing in. Our strategy finalized in 2022. We now have a global team that is operating in eight different countries.
And in terms of these moments look like for women's economic empowerment in low and middle income countries, and in what areas have we made significant progress, and also where do we see the biggest gaps?
I think we've made significant progress in terms of addressing certain areas and places where there's been more stagnation or still room and opportunity for improvement. So one thing I'd say is that there has been a lot more discourse and recognition of the need to address women's economic empowerment and gender gaps, not only for women's empowerment, but as larger contributions to the economic growth and development of these countries. Having said that, there are still areas of stagnation. So gender gaps in digital inclusion, for example, have remained stagnant in the last 2 years. And while there was a lot of progress earlier, we see that there hasn't been much happening recently in terms of enabling more women to access the internet or getting these gender gaps closed. There's been a lot of progress, for example, in launching large livelihoods programs as well, either as pilots or as scale-ups in countries. And we see a lot of opportunity here to enable women to have the resources, whether it be capital or skilling or public work programs, to improve access to livelihoods. There's also a number of countries who are entering the childcare space in lower middle income countries, recognizing this as a constraint. But we still have 350 million children who need childcare and don't have access to it. So it's a problem that still needs a fair amount of effort and energy.
Building on some of the areas where we've seen significant progress that you just alluded to, could you speak about some of the programs that Gates has funded that work to address these broader challenges and issues related to women's economic empowerment? And specifically, it'd be interesting to hear if there's certain programs that are focused on women that might be unconventional or that you found surprising that might be interesting for our listeners.
Let me tell you first a little bit about some of the programs that we're doing, and then I think we can say a little bit about some that might be interesting. So, for example, one of the exciting programs is this large multi-donor facilitated initiative led by the World Bank called Invest in Childcare, which is catalyzing over $180 million of funding for childcare in low and middle income countries, enabling countries to pilot, test, and scale innovations of different kinds of models to address childcare and attract women also into the care economy. Now, this could be, for example, through community-based models, private sector models, entrepreneur-led models, or government-provided and government-led models. And I think it's interesting to see the sort of take-up and interest from governments across the globe on this issue, and also growing evidence and a growing evidence base that shows childcare is important for women, but also for children and their families.
No, sorry, keep going.
Another interesting initiative is really working with GSMA to help mobile network operators actually improve digital inclusion programs and offerings for women. Now, you may not think of that as a very typical gender-led program, but many digital programs, whether they're apps or devices or subsidies, are not necessarily designed with women in mind. And this is a critical effort to not only shed light on the gender gaps in digital inclusion and the fact that they're not being closed, but to design apps that are most useful for women micro-entrepreneurs, so really women, poor, low-income women in the informal economy who may or may not have access to digital tools and products, and helping better design for them while showing that there is a business case and an investment case for companies to really design with women in mind.
Research shows that investing in women is good for families, communities, and economies, and pays dividends in terms of inclusive economic growth and human capital. Basically, women's economic empowerment does not just benefit women, as you've also alluded. How can we raise greater awareness about these positive externalities?
I think in a number of ways. First is we often tend to operate in silos. So there's a gender community, there's an ECD community, there's a community that works on firms and enterprises. And I think it's really important and critical that people recognize that gender is an integral factor in many of these initiatives, important for their success, and the fact that there are externalities for other communities. So to give you an example, in the childcare space, There's a sort of gender community and an ECD community that's focused on child nutrition and child health and child education. It's really important to break those silos down and join and combine efforts to see where you can leverage positive externalities in both directions, and not only raise greater awareness, but sort of pool resources to ensure that we're maximizing and optimizing our investments.
Taking kind of a step back, I'd love to ask you to imagine a future where gender takes center stage in international development. What would this future look like to you, and what kind of gives you hope thinking ahead?
That's a great question. I often think about the statistic that it will take another 136 years to close the global gender gap, and that I won't actually see that necessarily in my own lifetime. But what gives me hope is that there is a growing recognition of the need for gender transformative approaches. So not just programming for women, but really programming that changes gender inequalities, removes structural barriers, and empowers marginalized and disadvantaged populations. And that's what gives me hope. A future like this is one where I see, there not being gaps in labor force participation. For example, not being gaps in the sort of distribution of unpaid and domestic care work at home, having equal opportunities to access smartphones, capital, assets and loans and savings and rights to closing the sort of gender gaps also in rights and laws that men and women have. That's what a gender equal future would at least have some reflection of.
A great note to end on. Thank you so much. It was great having you today. Thanks for your time. And I feel like I learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners learned a lot. So really great to have you, Biba. Thank you. Next, I'm joined by Verena Winder. Verena is the Chief of Staff for the Secretary of State's Office of Global Women's Issues, or SGWE for short, at the U.S. Department of State, where she leads the office's policy development, interagency coordination, and strategic operations. Welcome, Verena. Let's jump in. Can you tell me a bit about your work at the State Department's Office of Global Women's Issues? How are you and your office approaching topics related to women's economic empowerment more broadly?
Thanks so much, Priyanka, for that warm welcome. Thanks for asking me to do this and for giving us a little bit of a platform to talk a little bit about our work. And so, as you mentioned, I serve as Chief of Staff in SGWE, which is the Secretary's Office of Global Women's Issues, which is the office at the U.S. Department of State with a mandate to promote women's and girls' empowerment and really integrate gender equality and the conduct of overall U.S. foreign policy, whether that's in our policy development, whether that's in our foreign assistance programming, or of course, whether that's in our diplomacy. And to be maybe a little bit cheeky about how we do that, our office, which is headed by a global ambassador, Dr. Geeta Rao Gupta, we serve often as a squeaky wheel. Wherever, a program is being debated or a foreign policy trip is being planned or a speech planned, our job is really to ask, how is this going to affect women and girls, especially differently? And what can we do as an office to ensure that the perspectives and needs of women and girls are also taken into account? So I think this conversation today is really about women's economic empowerment, but I want to emphasize that we break our work into at least three broad policy lanes, one of them, of course, being women's economic security, women's economic empowerment. The other two are women, peace, and security, and then, of course, addressing gender-based violence. And all of these policy areas have been consistent since our office was established in 2009, and I would say that's because all of these issues are truly interconnected. So just to take econ and economic empowerment, for example, if you're experiencing violence in the home, that's obviously going to impact how and whether you're able to show up to a job outside the home. If you're forced into a marriage as a child, that's going to affect whether you complete school, and that's, of course, going to affect your overall lifetime income. So under this administration, we've either launched or we're busy implementing existing strategies on each of these policy issues and also trying to build the capacity of the rest of the department to make them real.
What would you say this moment looks like for women's economic security kind of at the global level? And where have we seen a lot of progress made, and where do some of the challenges still persist?
Yeah, it's a really good question about, frankly, what is a very big challenge, because promoting women's economic security encompasses so much. I think it's important to note that in 2021, the WEF, or the World Economic Forum, which I don't think is in anyone's mind sort of an organization focused primarily on gender equality or on women's rights, notes that at our current rate of global progress, it would take 268 years to reach gender parity in the economy. So just to put that in context, if we go back 268 years, the United States wasn't even an idea yet. That was, I think, right around the start of the Seven Years' War. That's really how long we're taking. And I think that's especially stark because those data, the 268 years stat, comes from 2021. And just this month, a new report from the World Bank came out that notes that the gender gap for women in the global workplace is actually even wider than previously thought. So 268 years is actually probably a lot longer. I could sort of go through in terms of stats what that all encompasses, but really I think a couple of really important ones to keep in mind. Globally, only 47% of women, compared to 72% of men, are active in the global labor market. Women perform 76% of all unpaid care work globally. That's three times the amount as men. In 37 economies, which actually includes 500 million women, women have less than half of the legal rights of men. So that's everything encompassing from pension benefits to the ability to own land, the ability to open a bank account, establish a business, even the time that you're allowed to work if you're a woman. And then I think just to link it back to gender-based violence at the top, in a world where one in three women actually do continue to experience physical and or sexual violence, women globally have barely a third of legal protections they need. So those are laws, for example, protecting you against domestic violence or sexual harassment in the workplace, against child marriage, against femicide. These are just really, really huge challenges. And so that's, I think, the global moment that we're in. And what we are trying to do as an administration is just to move that needle, lifting up new and emerging industries where women's access to good jobs becomes a win-win for everybody. So here I'm thinking about Vice President Harris's launch of the Women in Sustainable Economy public-private partnership last year, which has mobilized over $1.4 billion from governments, private sector, civil society to bolster women's participation in emerging industries like clean energy. And we're also investing over 5 years, up to $50 million to the World Bank's Investment in Child Care Fund to expand access to quality child care and early learning programs all across the world. And then for us, particularly in our office, it's part of sort of a larger commitment to use our foreign assistance to support women's and girls' economic security through what we're calling the GIA Fund, or the Gender Equity and Equality Action Fund, which is managed by USAID, our partners, and also implemented by us. And we're supporting about 58 activities across 63 countries in just its first year. And that is just the foreign assistance side of the house. I could talk on and on and on about all of the bilateral and multilateral and diplomacy activities that we're doing, from G7 to G20 to APEC, but maybe I'll stop there.
That's great. No, thank you so much. We know that when women are economically secure, they invest in their families and their communities. What would you say we could do to raise greater awareness around some of these positive externalities that come with investing in women? Who are some of the key players that we need on board to make significant traction on ensuring that women are equally economically secure as men?
Yeah, so first of all, I just want to say, I think it's really important to say up front that gender equality in all the spheres, that it's a moral and a strategic imperative. And I think if you care about this as a human rights issue or as an issue of equality, that is really terrific. And there are plenty of reasons to do so and plenty of reasons to care. And I think your question gets at sort of the folks who might not necessarily care about it on a sort of a moral level. But I think that there is also a security issue or a business one that's also terrific. There are plenty of data to support the fact that investments in women's economic security my boss actually likes to say it's that's an investment and not an expenditure. And I'll just maybe hit that analogy even further and say I think those investments are paying out dividends to everybody and not just stockholders, so to speak. McKinsey, so just to sort of go to the data, McKinsey, which like the WEF, probably not an organization you think of as completely focused on women, came out with a study about 8 years ago that demonstrated concretely that if women participated in the economy in the same way as men do, we could have expanded the economy by $28 trillion by next year. $28 trillion is actually bigger than the GDP of the entire U.S., and we remain, at least today, still the largest economy in the world. So $28 trillion, that's more money for everyone, no matter who you are. And I want to expand that a little bit because it's not just direct economic benefits that affect everyone. This conversation is about the economy, but we're also having this conversation at a moment when the world has the highest number of conflicts since World War II. And so I think it's really important to say, and I know that you took the same econometrics classes that I did, that gender inequality is actually a predictor of armed conflict. And the opposite is also true, that countries with more equal societies tend to experience more peace. So when we talk about this as a moral or a strategic imperative, this is not about getting anybody involved and doing women and girls a favor. This is really about, at the end of the day, do you want to grow your economy? Do you want you or do you want your kids to live in a more peaceful society? Do you want your business to be better poised for growth? And I think it's on us as people who care about these issues to sort of get outside of our own echo chambers and really speak to others about why this matters for everybody.
Building on some of these issues of gender-based violence that you alluded to, how do issues like sexual violence, technology-facilitated gender-based violence, or even early enforced marriage potentially impact women's economic security?
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. I know you know I care really deeply about this link. And before I sort of talk about the link between women's economic security and gender-based violence, I want to say, of course, unequivocally, gender-based violence, no matter how, no matter where it occurs, that's a human rights abuse, and that's just full stop. I should also say, and I think folks know this, but it's worth repeating, that it does have serious physical, mental health consequences that are both immediate. They're also intergenerational, and therefore, it should surprise absolutely no one that gender-based violence also comes with an economic cost to societies and not just to the individual bearing the violence. I think, you know, we don't have great data on this, but we know that it costs probably at least 2% of global GDP. We know it costs businesses money in terms of lost productivity. It costs women, their families money, as girls who might be forced to marry are also forced to forego their education. Or if women lose their jobs to deal with violence, that's also, of course, both an actual cost and an opportunity cost. So when we talk about gender-based violence, I also want to sort of broaden the scope beyond intimate partner violence or domestic violence and also talk about the cost of women's lack of safety in general in public spaces. And you asked about online violence. I would also talk a little bit about the sort of violence that women experience in physical spaces outside the home. So a few years ago, I think it was in 2017, the International Labor Organization found that limited access to and safety on public transport actually reduced women's probability of labor force participation by almost 17%. And that was because women were forgoing higher paying jobs or not attending better quality schools that happened to be further from the home because they don't feel safe getting there. So that's an example of one public space where women's safety is very much intertwined with their ability to make an income. And then I'd also point to the new sort of public space, the online space, where, and these data, you know, every time I think about them, I think this is probably an undercount, but an estimated 85% of women and girls have experienced what we're calling technology-facilitated gender-based violence. And by that, I really mean, you know, the sort of death threats, the rape threats, the harassment, the doxing, the stalking. We're just starting to really measure the impact of this type of violence. But I can tell you both, I mean, you could listen to the statements of the former prime ministers of New Zealand and Finland, but also just in private conversations with women around the world that I've had, whether I've been in Iceland, in Kenya, in Rwanda, in El Salvador, how detrimental this type of violence is to women's leadership and participation. Women who are really well established in their careers, be it, you know, business or science or law, politics, journalism, who now say, you know, to me and probably to their own daughters and to their own communities, I would never recommend this path. It's just too dangerous. And so I think that really terrifies me. What paths are left then if online spaces become dangerous ones? And how do you close a 268-year long gap, or possibly even like longer one, when opportunities are closing. So we're really concerned about this. We're not just hopefully admiring the problem. We are leaning into countering this kind of violence through leadership of the Global Partnership for Action on Gender-Based Online Harassment and Abuse. That is like the longest name. We generally just call it the Global Partnership. But through that, we're working with 13 other governments, along with an advisory group of other international organizations, civil society, the private sector, and of course survivors, to better understand, prevent, and address this kind of violence, whether that's through joint policy statements or increasingly actually programming. And here we've invested about $7 million to date in programs around the world focused on this kind of violence.
The work that will, thank you. As we near the wrap up of this podcast, I'm curious, do you have any final thoughts or advice on achieving women's economic security that you'd like to leave with our listeners today?
Sure. And if I can just maybe flip that on its head, governments love to issue calls to action, but I think that that question lends itself to a bit of a call to action. And really at the end of the day, we're going to need all hands on deck if we're actually going to achieve or close that 268-year long gap. And I promise that my office won't stop in its quest. And that's, of course, not enough. I think continued partnership with private sector, with civil society, with students, with anybody and everybody listening in is going to be indispensable. And that's because as we forge ahead, there are actually also many, many, many who would like to take us back. We're seeing that in new restrictions on who gets to attend school, what women can or cannot do in public, what they can wear in public, decriminalizing forms of violence. I'm not sure if your listeners are following what's happening in the Gambia, but that's a situation that we're watching really closely. So for our private sector colleagues, I think do your part, hire, pay, advance, source from, mentor women, and provide for the kinds of childcare and family leave that we know benefits everybody. We have a number of public-private partnerships in my office dedicated to advancing women's economic participation, including alliances to advance Indian, Pakistani, and Afghan women's economic security. We're always looking for more partners in these efforts. For those of you in academia, because of course this is at the CID, I think I can't underscore how powerful your curricula is, or how much it can change the trajectory of a woman's life. This was March, so we had 11 of 12 really amazing, what we call international women of courage with us. And they are women who are doing incredible, courageous, community-changing work, often at very, very great risk. And almost to a T, every single one of these women who were here from, you know, from Bangladesh, from Gambia, from Uganda, from Bosnia and Herzegovina, really from all over the world, talked about high school and university classes as their springboard to the life's work. So continue investing in those students, continue investing in curricula. And then for our civil society partners, I'd say the most important thing you can do is really to keep all of us to account, keep providing the research, keep advocating, keep refusing to accept challenges standing in our way. keep asking us all to do better. And then I think for the students in the audience, including those at our own alma mater, I think the thing that I would leave is just, you know, find the thing that you care about the most and find a way to make that count.
That was great, Brina. I feel like I learned so much from you. Thanks for a great conversation.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Finally, I'd like to welcome Wendy Telecki. Wendy is the head of the Women Entrepreneurs Finance Initiative Secretariat, which is housed in the World Bank and supports women entrepreneurs in over 60 developing countries around the world. In 2022, Ms. Telecki was named one of Forbes' 50 over 50 women in finance for her leadership in advocating for women's economic empowerment and entrepreneurship. Great to have you with us, Wendy. Can you tell us about the World Bank Group's Women Entrepreneurs Finance Initiative, or WEFI for short? How are you and your team approaching issues related to women's economic empowerment and financial security?
Sure. So WEFI is a program that sits in the World Bank, and it supports women entrepreneurs around the world in developing countries. We have funding from 14 donors, and we work with all of the multilateral development banks around the world. So not only with the World Bank and IFC, but also with the African Development Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the Islamic Development Bank, Inter-American Development Bank, and EBRD, helping them deploy programs around the world that support women entrepreneurs. So we're active in about 70 countries. We work across the entire ecosystem, as we call it, providing support for financial institutions to help them do more to finance women entrepreneurs, working with corporations to help them bring more women entrepreneurs into their supply chains. We work to do upskilling for women and training, networking, coaching for women. And also we work on the policy side. So we work with governments and regulators and others that are trying to put in place policies and deploy their own funds in ways that are gender smart and support women entrepreneurs.
That's great. Based off of all that, what would you say this moment looks like for women's economic empowerment in low and middle income countries? Where are you seeing a lot of progress? And then where are the challenges still existing today?
Yeah, so it's really a mixed bag right now in the around the world for women's economic empowerment. We've seen some advances in terms of, in some countries, a greater female labor force participation. Now we're seeing some backtracking in a few countries on that, so it's not all positive. Likewise, we see more and more women getting access to the internet, digital technologies, and being able to deploy those in their lives in ways that can help them build their livelihoods. But it's not enough, and the gaps with men are still quite significant. We also have seen a lot of really good research showing exactly what barriers women are facing, and that shows a lot of, you know, very entrenched issues in many countries around social norms, things like access to care services that allow women to work or become entrepreneurs. And there's just, you know, really the beginnings of trying to more systemically address those challenges. We also see on the legal front improvements in laws facing women. Many countries are looking at laws. They're looking at things like gender budgeting and seeing how they can use public sector resources to make sure that they're benefiting women as much as possible. But still, women around the world only have about 76% of the rights of men. So there's still many, many gaps, and there's still a long way to go in terms of getting to where we want to be. In our space, where we look at women's entrepreneurship, we see there's still a financing gap for women entrepreneurs of about $1.7 billion. So we know that that's like a really significant challenge that women have everywhere. And we want to make sure that that's eliminated. So we're doing a lot in that space to improve financing.
And building on that point, how are you working with other actors to close those financing gaps for women entrepreneurs?
Yeah, so we have, as I mentioned, we have projects in about 70 countries around the world. And we work with over 400 different institutions locally in those countries. About half of those institutions are financial institutions. So we work with banks, we work with microfinance institutions, fintechs. We work with accelerators and incubators that are supporting women entrepreneurs. And we do a lot of work with them to help them understand what women entrepreneurs need, what kinds of products and services they're looking for, and also how to manage their, you know, kind of customer experience to make sure that some of these biases and norms that often get embedded in all kinds of processes are eliminated. And also that those financial institutions shine a mirror on themselves to make sure that women are interacting with institutions that themselves have strong gender policies, strong leadership from women, and opportunities for promotion for women. So we're looking at how they can affect their own internal operations as well as their financing externally. In addition to kind of helping with the technical side of how to improve financing for women, we also help with financing. So our partners have supported about $3.6 billion in financing for women entrepreneurs around the world. And we do that through blended finance mechanisms for the most part. We do a lot of performance incentives, which incentivize banks to do and other financial institutions to do more. We've helped issue bonds for women entrepreneurs. We do guarantees, a lot of work with credit lines, but also some on equity and working with funds. So we're also part of getting part of the solution for getting financing out the door to women. And then we also see that it's not just a matter of the private sector actors, but also the public sector. So we're doing a lot of work now with regulators and financial infrastructure partners to make sure that they're really thinking about the policy environment and the regulatory environment to improve financing for women entrepreneurs. We have a new initiative, for example, called the We Finance Code, which is being launched in 26 countries around the world that brings together the public sector and the private sector to make commitments to do more to support women entrepreneurs. And really importantly, to improve the database for women entrepreneurs. So we don't know in, I think, only two countries report right now to OECD on how much financing is going to women entrepreneurs. And the We Finance Code aims to change that by getting, hopefully, all countries around the world to be tracking that and put, you know, for financial institutions to start doing it more systematically so that they can use that data to really improve their products and services.
Thank you. That's super helpful. Shifting gears, we know that the climate crisis is not gender neutral. Women are disproportionately affected by the impacts of climate change, but in turn, they're integral parts in both climate mitigation and adaptation. How would you say we can bring about a more climate-focused lens to women's economic empowerment?
Yeah, this is incredibly important as we look at where women are acting, where they're affected by climate change. And what we know is that about, it's under 1% of overseas development aid that's focused on climate is actually going to support women primarily. So we have very little funding that's going to support women. And within that, we have a particularly small amount that's going to women who are leading on the business side or to support women who are entrepreneurs. So we see a lot of support going to help, you know, get women into policy discussions, to be parts of negotiations, to work with, you know, community development activities. But what we're not seeing is investments in women who can lead from the enterprise perspective. And so this is something that we're very focused on right now. We're looking to do a lot more to support women entrepreneurs, to help them accelerate their businesses in the climate space, and also to help get financing out to women who need to make their businesses more resilient in places where climate is really having an immediate effect on the risks that they're facing as businesses. You know, women have had, as you've mentioned, a much greater impact from climate, but this is coming on the heels of COVID, supply chain disruptions, and many other challenges globally that have affected women more severely. So getting women to be, women entrepreneurs to be much more resilient is a critical focus for us, and getting financing in their hands to do that is really important. But in addition to just making, you know, all female-led businesses more resilient, we really want to make sure we're investing in women to lead climate solutions. So, you know, we think about this in the long run. You know, we don't want to get through a period of transition, the green transition, 20 or 30 years from now. Hopefully we'll make it to, you know, that, well, that'll be a successful transition. But we don't want to get there and find that, oops, we forgot to finance the women-led firms that could lead that transition. We know that, you know, only 2% of equity goes to women-led firms generally. It's even smaller when you're looking at tech and climate businesses. So we really, really need to focus now on getting more women entrepreneurs financed to create new solutions and to lead this transition.
Absolutely. Switching gears again, imagine a future where gender takes center stage in international development. What would you say this future looks like to you?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of awareness in international development on the gender side. I mean, there's a big focus on mainstreaming gender into, you know, all of the operations that we see in international development. I mean, the MDBs that we work with are all very much focused on ensuring that most of their programs have a gender component to them. And we see things, you know, like embedding this into gender budgeting and financial sector operations and things where, you know, they weren't really gender focused in the past. So I think we've made the first steps of really trying to get more awareness and experimenting with what tools can work. But as I said, I think we have a lot farther to go. Our diagnostic tools are getting better to understand what the gaps are, but our ability to scale up solutions that will close the gaps is really still quite limited. And so, you know, a lot of what we're trying to think about is how do we create scalable solutions or share solutions that work more broadly around the world and really focus that on having more, you know, getting to balance, I should say, you know, not, we're not trying to have women lead every single business, but really making sure that businesses are balanced in terms of management, that we have a balance in terms of women and men in finance, making decisions in finance, making, you know, allocation decisions. That's really, really important for getting more financing out the door to women, is having the decision makers be women. So management and thinking about the who is actually making the decisions is very important, and having them be much more aware of biases and how norms, gender norms, play out. And then also, you know, really every institution needs to be thinking about designing in a way that really takes into consideration how women experience products and services that are being put out there for development purposes. So we see, you know, a real need to mainstream this work and put a lot more work into innovation and thinking about solutions that work.
Thanks for sharing that. As we wrap up this podcast episode, do you have any final thoughts about how we can achieve women's economic empowerment that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Yeah, I think partnering is really important. I talked a little bit about the We Finance Code. What we found with the work that all of our partners are doing is we're coming up with a lot of really innovative solutions that are helping individual institutions make a difference. And, you know, those then and focusing on the institutional capacity and their ability to create sustained change that will last beyond the time of a project is really important. But if we want to do more, we really need to think systemically and think about how we partner to drive change forward together by leveraging both the public and the private sector. We're trying to do that with the We Finance Code by bringing the regulators and the financial institutions, the donors, the technical assistance providers, all to the table towards a common goal and towards a common set of commitments. And I think we need to be thinking about those kinds of systems change efforts so that our individual efforts to make change in one location or with one institution can really be scaled up and have much, much, much greater impact, which is what we need. So that's really my main focus, is trying to figure out how we do this, but we do it at scale and systemically.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Wendy. This was great. Really nice to have you today. And thanks so much for your time. Really learned a lot from you.
You're very welcome. Very happy to be here.
Thank you so much to all three of our speakers today, who really shed some light on where we've made progress and where work remains when it comes to women's economic empowerment in low and middle income countries worldwide. Thanks so much for tuning in today.